From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Caroline Lee, whose latest novel is Prize Women, published by Harper Perennial. Caroline Lee grew up in Jersey and gained a first in English literature and creative writing from the University of Warwick, where she now teaches on the creative writing degree. Her fiction and poetry have been shortlisted for the Bridport Prize, the Fish Short Story Competition, and various Flash Fiction Prizes. Her work often explores the pressure of small communities and fractured relationships, as well as the way our history shapes our beliefs and behavior. Here's a little information about Prize Women. Toronto, 1926. Knowing that he will die without an heir, childless millionaire Charles Miller leaves behind a controversial will. The recipient of his fortune will be decided in a contest that will become a media sensation and be known as the Great Stork Derby. His money will go to the winner, the woman who bears the most children in the 10 years after his death. It is a bequest that will have dramatic consequences for the lives of two women, allies and close friends. Lily DeMarco is young, pregnant, and terrified of her alcoholic, violent husband. When her town is damaged by an earthquake, she flees to Toronto, arriving by chance on the doorstep of the glamorous May Thébault. While May presents an elegant, confident face to the world, she secretly struggles with her own tortured past and a present consumed with the never-ending burdens of motherhood. Lily enters her life at a breaking point, and soon a fierce friendship blossoms between the women. That is until the Great Depression and the contest with its alluring prize threatens to tear their friendship and their lives apart. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Caroline Lee. I thought we could just talk to start about the Great Stork Derby and how you came to hear about it originally.
Yeah, thank you. So it wasn't something I'd heard of before. I kind of stumbled across video footage, like archived video footage that I found on YouTube. And I still can't remember what I'd put into my search or if it was just something that got thrown at me, because I do tend to read kind of articles about events in history. But just of these women with just enormous numbers of children lining them up, ready to have their photographs taken. It just was instantly a little bit baffling and intriguing as to why these women were having their photos taken. And then I started reading about the story, and it does sound like a practical joke. And I don't know if Charles Vance Miller, the lawyer who was involved, I don't know if he had intended it to be initially a practical joke. He was kind of a renowned prankster. And the rest of his will was also, slightly crazy. He'd left shares in a brewery to a group of teetotalers. He'd left shares in a jockey club to a kind of an anti-gambling group, and a house in Jamaica to four lawyers who could only inherit it if they all stayed there at the same time and they all hated each other. But then none of these things actually kind of existed. So he was sort of this slightly comedic, a sadistic character. Then when I looked into the will, it does sort of sound like it's going to be almost the punchline to this elaborate joke, this ninth clause, which is that he leaves the remainder of his fortune, which, because of the economic circumstances in the 10 years after his death, ended up being the modern equivalent of millions, but leaving it to the woman in Toronto who can have the greatest number of children. It initially sounds like it might be quite funny until you think what those women would have been through. And I think that was kind of the instant connection for me. I mean, I have two children, and I love my two children. I love them so much, but it's definitely enough. I don't feel like I balance all the things in my life very well at the best of times. Late 1920s, 1930s, Canada and the Great Depression was definitely not the best of times. So just enormous economic deprivation for these poor women who were then potentially kind of encouraged or cajoled, or probably in some cases kind of almost forced into having children for for their partners or for men, for husbands who kind of wanted a share in this money. So it just tapped into an awful lot of things I was kind of and am interested in writing about, to do with kind of bodily autonomy and female identity and motherhood. And at the time that I came across the video footage, I was sort of, I wanted to write something about motherhood anyway, but I just kind of hadn't found, it sounds awful to sound it, like position it as a hook to hang it on. But it was the strangest experience writing it, because I felt like I had this kind of melting pot of ideas. And then suddenly it felt like the right story to say some of the things that I wanted to say and to kind of contribute to the discussion in the way that I hope the book does.
Yeah, I don't think that's a terrible thing to say at all. I mean, I think you do want it to be a story that's readable, that makes people think about the things that you want to convey. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it absolutely did. It was such a bizarre thing that he did. And of course, he's not around afterwards to see what came of it or how people were affected by it. And that's the greatest prank of all. He doesn't have to feel any remorse for having put people through something awful or difficult. So I want to talk about the opening of the book, which is from the point of view of your character, Lily. Mm-hmm. But there's this sentence, May betrays Lily for the second time in a courtroom. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was such an interesting opening on a number of levels. First of all, we're Lily's point of view, but the first name we hear is May.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting thing. And then also we have the promise of a story. There's like the betrayal for the second time. Anyway, I just wonder if you want to talk about this opening and what you want an opening to accomplish.
It's so difficult, isn't it? Because you want an opening to kind of, I know that openings can do many things. You can sort of lure the reader in, and I'm a big fan of kind of description and setting, so much so that sometimes when I'm planning a story, I have to kind of almost put that to one side, because I think probably what I want to do is really, you know, grab the reader by the scruff of the neck and drag them into the story. And so it was quite a deliberately kind of intriguing sentence in quite a mechanistic way, in that I'm a huge fan of openings that imply that there's a whole other story that has taken place before the opening. So I'm sort of thinking things like, and I'm not making a comparison with Marquez, but I am at the same time, the 100 Years of Solitude, and that great opening sentence about, and I don't want to kind of quote the whole thing, but your listeners can, if they don't already know, it should go and look up the brilliant, it's such a fabulous opening sentence. And you have a character who's in the middle of peril, and him kind of remembering past events, it's this wonderful kind of discovery of ice that's referred to in the opening sentence. And I just, I love the way that that sentence works in terms of giving you an idea, not just of the current peril, but kind of past, I don't know, a relationship, I suppose, which was really what I wanted to immediately bring into the story. Because although Prize Women is a story about, you know, families and motherhood and bodily autonomy and kind of the coercion and scenario that these women found themselves in, I didn't want to write something that felt totally bleak and hopeless. And so one of the things that I set out to write was a story that centralized and really highlighted the kind of the empowering nature of female friendships and relationships, and the idea that something ultimately could feel redemptive, and that women kind of find something that's hopeful throughout this. So although I'm starting with the idea of betrayal, you know, it is the relationship between the two women that kind of that carries through the story about, you know, just women having babies. I mean, I don't mean to trivialize by saying just women having babies, but, you know, I didn't want it to just be kind of a list of hideous things that happen to these poor women. So,
I loved, I'm going off script a little bit here, but just something you said just reminded me of all the depictions of women in this book, mostly mothers. You have Teresa, who is this lovely, I just loved that character so much, even though she kind of comes and goes and she's not one of your main characters, but she's just lovely. And you have Lily, who I think of as our main character, even though May has kind of equal space in the book. I think because you begin in Lily's point of view, and there's more of a reason that I think she's your main character that we can talk about later. But and then there's May. And then there's Millicent, who doesn't have children. And I loved that you included her because she isn't a bad person, but she has no clue, no clue what these women are going through.
Yeah.
And that was a good perspective to bring. I mean, she's wealthy. She's also without children herself, maybe yet.
Mm-hmm.
And she just thinks it's like playtime to come over and be with the kids. And she makes things worse in certain ways. And so it was fun to see her kind of come and go, because it was just like, oh my gosh.
I really enjoyed, I really enjoyed writing Millicent and Therese, actually. I think for all that I said that I didn't want it to just kind of be a litany of doom for these women, both May and Lily's stories carry a certain intensity, and I felt like Millicent and Therese offered some relief from that. Mm-hmm. And not that I wanted it to be a light novel, but, you know, I feel like there has to be some balance. Millicent, I found her incredibly amusing, and she felt very real. I think although she is entirely clueless, but I think lots of people can relate or can recognize that character of someone who walks in full of advice just has no clue. So
right, or even recognize themselves from an earlier point before they had children. Mm-hmm. And realize, I did not know what I was talking about.
And yet I was there with all of those judgments. Yes.
Exactly. So I want to talk a little bit about the way you structured the book, and something specific about point of view that I was talking about. We start in this courtroom scene, which I briefly touched upon, where we are told that about the second time of a betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go back and we go back into these women's stories and their history. And Lily's story is told in great detail. She had a troubled marriage to an abusive man who used to be kind to her, but as things went poorly for them, he became very abusive. Then there's an earthquake. There's the day that she and her son flee their ruined home for Toronto, hoping for a fresh start. And that's all told in scene. And then we hear May's backstory, but it's not in scene. It's a paragraph or two of very densely but detailed summary of what she's been through in her life, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I learned plenty to understand or feel like I could begin to understand May. And then, of course, you expand upon her character as the story goes. But I wondered if we could talk about when a background should be more detailed, more in scene, and when it can be more summarized like May's, and why you did that.
That's such a good question, and it's such a difficult decision, you know, page by page to make that decision as to where exposition is necessary. With Lily's story, I suppose I wanted that sense of she struggles a lot more than May because she's coming sort of immediately from this abusive relationship. Whereas when we meet May, she is kind of in a position, certainly at the point we meet her, of financial privilege, although that isn't necessarily her background. I am always conscious when there's a character who kind of suffers a lot and has been through a lot, and this is from past books that I've written, that sometimes there is a reader response, and perhaps even my own sense when I'm reading it back, that it's quite difficult to go along with that and it feels quite unfair that people can be quite harsh on a character, going, well, why didn't the character just kind of react in this way at this point? I would like to think that as a reader, maybe people reflect a bit more and think, well, actually, that's quite a hard experience for that character. But I really wanted the reader to sympathise with everything Lily had been through, to perhaps justify later on her reactions, and so that we don't feel like she's just being weak, because she is quite passive, because she's quite disadvantaged. She's dependent on May. She's, she is kind of poor for a lot of the novel, and also has been kind of mistreated at various points. And I didn't want her just to appear passive. And I felt like going into more detail, helped us to kind of understand her motivation and where she was coming from. With May's story, when I started doing a similar thing when I was in the first draft, it just ended up feeling too slow. So I didn't ever go into that kind of scene by scene kind of detailed description of May's past, even in the first draft. And quite often I will do things like that and then I will edit them out, although I knew what had happened to May. Because I think by the time I'd got to May's point of view, because we'd already had Lily's journey across to Toronto, I just had that kind of that writer's sense, I think, of a pressure of we need to get to the main story and the point of what happens to May at this moment for the reader. The thing that is important is for the two characters to meet and for things to unfold from there. So I think I think it's useful sometimes when I'm writing to think of it like a piece of music, I suppose. And I just felt like the overall structure called for something that was faster paced at that point, hence the exposition. But I teach writing and have taught writing at the University of Warwick over here. And it's really hard when students ask, like, how do I recount this? Why can't I just do this through exposition? And it's such a hard balance to explain, because I think a lot of it is sort of instinctive. And even when you think you've got it right, you know, some readers will come to the story and will be like, well, this bit felt too slow. And often it is that scene by scene unfolding that maybe feels too slow, particularly possibly when I was recounting the stories of women in a domestic space. And quite often, you know, I mean, this is my daily lived existence of hoovering and washing up and loading the dishwasher yet again. And it is slow. But for some of the space of the novel, part of that domestic routine felt necessary, and it's just kind of working out when I need to move on from that. And I think, I hope I get it right, but it's a difficult decision.
I also think the reason it works so well is that as the story goes on, there are more and more moments where we kind of get to a point where May has a kind of complicated inner journey, right? And she's concerned about how she looks on the outside. She's concerned about seeming a certain way. I mean, she's a person who grew up without money and then she has money, so she's worried that she looks like a snob or that she looks cold. Mm-hmm. And so we're hearing about all of that, and you infuse that with perspective from her background. So we kind of still keep getting more of that. And that actually brings me to another question I had, which is writing about sort of the complexity of people and that people aren't all black and white. So, for example, Tony, who is Lily's first husband, who we meet briefly and learn that he's a terrible and abusive person right at the beginning. But you tell us that he used to make her little metal sculptures out of things that he found in the boatyard. And I really liked that because I don't think people are born evil. You know, I think that they live through hard times to become evil, or they go through mental illness that leads them into behavior that's terrible. There's so many, it's just so complex, and I like it when that's presented in the prose. And I also like, even though I kind of like Lily best, to be honest, I hate to say that.
Yeah, me too.
And it may be because she's a little passive, as you said, and she's an Italian immigrant, and so even from the very start, she's sort of not on her home turf, even before she gets to Toronto. But I do admire the way that you present the turmoil within May, and the fact that she has this darkness that's born of her experience and her fear about her life. So many different levels, you know. I mean, she doesn't have a perfect marriage. She's not comfortable with her money. She's not a natural. I don't know that anybody's a natural mother, but it doesn't come easily to her to be a mother. She's a very loving mother, so anyway, there's all this inner conflict in May, and I love that. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder if you can speak to. Not having, I'm kind of feeding you lines, not having black and white characters.
Thank you. It's a really great thing to hear, because I think I do an awful lot of, I spend an awful lot of time thinking about characters and about how to make them more complex. And very like you, I don't think that you have characters who who are totally villainous, I think quite often they're just in a space where they maybe are misunderstood or disadvantaged. And I'm always conscious in a previous book where I had a character who was, and again, it was in The Glass Woman. The husband in that is kind of very abusive. And I'm always interested in kind of looking at what in a character's background might have led them to kind of to be in a position where they are so controlling and so frightened of how other people around them might behave that they essentially become abusive. And I do think that in most cases that's really what kind of happens. In sort of past relationships I can think of, with the like context and hindsight, although I've been kind of massively disempowered in relationships, and I could kind of very quickly summarize them and say, oh, that was an abusive relationship, I can still look back into that person's past and go, well, that's why this person has behaved in this way. I spend quite a lot of time looking at kind of the work of psychologists. I mean, there are loads of brilliant books on kind of childhood trauma and how that kind of works its way into people's kind of current behavior patterns. And I'm sort of intrigued by that. And I like, where possible, to sort of bring that to bear on characters. So I think with May, who I know you asked about specifically, I was kind of conscious of that idea of her being seen from the outside initially, and that idea of kind of appearances, because I think that kind of fear of letting go is often what drives controlling or difficult behavior, and maybe working from the outside in. So it's kind of a balance of those things. But yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah, no, and I kind of recognized May's, like if I see a woman, a contemporary woman, mm-hmm. that's in the situation May is in, I might make a snap judgment, you know, and that's not fair because I don't know who that person is or where they come from, but it is easy to do, particularly it's somebody who's not suffering, somebody who's, you know, clearly, I don't know, driving a Mercedes with a latte in her
hand. No, I'm the same. And I wanted that for the reader. So you were asking about, I know we talked a little bit before about the way that I introduced the two characters. And the first time Lily sees May, I kind of deliberately described it. She almost has this kind of sheen, this facade where she's perfectly made up and she has, you know, her eyes are hidden behind dark glasses and she pulls up in this enormous car. And as a reader, we know that there's some inner turmoil going on, but at the same time, she's got this facade that we're aware is a facade, but Lily isn't. And I sort of wanted to work in that layering. And hopefully over the course of the novel, shift the reader's sympathies. So I think like you, Lily is probably my favorite character, but I sort of wanted to shift our sympathy for May as well. So that, because one of the big drives for the reader hopefully is, you know, who does end up with the money? And I didn't want it to just to be as simple as one woman is kind of clearly more deserving than the other, because both women kind of need this money, not just kind of to pull them out of poverty, but also because they have no choice. You know, it's not just as simple as food on the table and clothes on their backs. For Lily, it's kind of it's a choice, as you know, and how she manages to escape from a difficult relationship.
I want to talk about setting. This book takes place in the years before and after the stock market crash. It's in a city. And I loved, do you mind if I read a little bit from the book?
Oh, no, I'd love that. Thank you.
Okay. This is from Lily's perspective. Outside the car, the streets rush past unimaginably fast, a blur of buildings and people. She looks up at the thin sliver of sky. She is so used to being surrounded by the huge expanse of blue that it's strange to see the sky cut off and divided, strange to have her gaze brought back to the busy streets and the sharp shapes of the buildings. Lily tries to take it all in, the women in short dresses and neat hats, the men on bicycles and behind the wheels of motor cars, smells of smoke and meat cooking and river water and sewerage. So I thought that was beautiful. But then I also want to just like compare it to something else. After the crash, May is looking out the window And the streets have become, this is a quote, littered with old newspapers and the gleam of glass from smashed bottles. But it is the people that fill May with dismay. Where have they come from, these grubby ghosts who haunt every corner and seem to multiply every night? May watches a group of men huddled around a trash can fire. Their clothes are drab and dirty, but as the car draws closer, May can see the fine cut of their ruined coats, the expensive leather of their battered shoes. I loved that because we've all seen trash can fires before, but I love that you zoomed in and you showed us who they were before. With the cut of their suits and the leather of their shoes. It was just, I just thought that was wonderful. So I wanted to talk a little bit about writing setting and also doing the research to get it right.
Thank you. I enjoy writing setting a lot because I think it can, you know, it can it isn't just the case of it adding atmosphere. In the example you read out just there, I wanted to give a sense of the story that people's clothes tell about them, and kind of the way that the setting can add kind of richness and can people the story with more than just kind of cardboard cutout characters. I read a lot of poetry. I know that quite often on your wonderful podcast you ask for kind of writing prompts, and one of them, and I'm sorry if this kind of throws things out of sequence, but one of the best prompts I can give is to kind of read poetry when you're planning, because sometimes just a line or an idea will jump out, and it's just enough to kind of to get you started, particularly if you're stuck. Setting kind of does so much in terms of kind of moving the story forward, and I'm so aware of how a character moving from one location to another might be kind of internally impacted by the external surroundings, and I kind of want to keep a balance of those two things. In terms of making sure that I got it right, I read as much as I could on the impact of the crash and the depression, and it was difficult to find enough material on Canada in particular. There was an awful lot focused on the US and around New York, so I hope I've got the details right. A lot of the writing that I did for this was during lockdown, so I didn't have the opportunity to travel and to find out more, but I kind of felt like that sense of claustrophobia and of kind of being stuck in one place almost fed itself into the novel itself. And I do think that as a writer, it's almost impossible to escape that. Whatever setting you're describing, I think your own internal landscape kind of finds its way into the book. So even though kind of I couldn't travel during that time, the sort of the sense of claustrophobia was definitely there.
Okay, great. Thank you. I wanted to ask you about writing this friendship between Lily and May, and then wrecking it for a little while.
Yeah.
Or throwing a wrench in. They have such a beautiful friendship, and then, of course, you know, life interferes and things become complicated between them. And I won't go into how that resolves or doesn't resolve eventually. It's not my focus. But I am curious about what the experience is of creating their friendship and then messing with it.
So I wanted the friendship to be the kind of the lodestone throughout the novel. As we said earlier, the initial focus, although Lily's in the courtroom, is on the friendship and the idea of betrayal. Mm-hmm. I felt that, along with just having, I didn't just want characters who are motivated by financial gain, as needful as they are of financial assistance. It's not like they're kind of wealthy people looking to get wealthier. It is a life and death situation for the women with in terms of getting the money or not. But I felt like the emotional space within the novel was calling out for something more than simply kind of a desire for money and just friendship. So I wanted to explore kind of the nuances of a close female friendship and how that can be pulled apart so completely by circumstances outside of of the character's control. And quite often, I think, you know, even in contemporary circumstances, it's something that's quite easy to see how. And I think, I mean, I'm sure it happens in male friendships as well. And I don't want to make enormous kind of sweeping gender stereotypes. But I think there's something very specific about close female friendships, which then become quite destructively tricky. I don't want to kind of draw allusions to any sort of kind of celebrity friendships, but the idea of kind of closeness that then is totally ripped away for my characters. Obviously, that in Lily's case, halfway through the book, she's homeless. But I try, even though I'm writing historical fiction, to bring a sensibility to kind of the universal kind of conditions that people find themselves in. And the idea of like a friendship, which is so key and so absolute, then being taken away is, I think, that something that does feel universal. And for the women in this story, their bodily autonomy is being taken away from them. They're being kind of essentially forced into a situation where they're having to have these large families. So the idea that this friendship is the one thing that to hold on to that might kind of ultimately offer some hope or redemption felt like something that could carry the novel through, but that by imperiling that, it was something that was kind of, it was more than just the threat of losing their money. It was sort of this hopeful thing, I think.
Right. I mean, both the money and the friendship are things they desperately need and don't have at the beginning of the novel. So they kind of, that's interesting. I want to ask you, I always ask my guests what they've been reading lately that they might recommend to listeners. So what have you been reading?
I have been reading Women Talking by Miriam Toews, which I love her stuff. She's such a brilliant writer. And she writes character so well. And she all her books I've read in the past have been, although some of them cover quite bleak subject matter, I'm not recommending, I'm just alluding to all my puny sorrows and just trying not to add to the list the number of books I'm recommending. But that is also brilliant, but very bleak. But Women Talking is inspired by a true story of women in a religious community, which is very restrictive, who were systematically over a number of years essentially drugged and then raped by the men in their community. She doesn't really write about that. The book concerns itself with aftermath. So we meet the women who have got the span of essentially one day while the men of the town are away in order to decide what to do. And they're deciding whether to stay, whether to leave the community, or whether to fight. And the subject matter is unbelievably harrowing. And yet she brings such compassion. And ultimately, there's such hopefulness in the novel. And I know we were just talking about female friendship. But I really think it is that kind of that sense of community and understanding and compassion that all the women hang on to that really everything she writes is brilliant. But it really is. It's a wonderful, haunting, but quite hopeful novel, especially given that it's about something that's so hideous. And the other book that I would like to recommend that I've been reading is Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. It's too simplistic to say it's a retelling, a reframing perhaps of David Copperfield, but set in kind of, I'm going to put in inverted commas, I know your listeners won't be able to hear, inverted commas, hillbilly America, but kind of looks at the OxyContin problem in small communities, the way that's been perpetrated by the government, kind of pulling away any kind of rights and financial support within those communities and the way they've been sort of decimated. And I loved it. I mean, her writing's wonderful anyway, but I loved it for the way in which she took so many of the social concerns that Dickens was writing about in Victorian Britain and the desperate poverty that people found themselves in. And she translates it into characters who feel entirely recognizable and yet totally new. And it's such a refreshing take on a really well-known story. And I think it's brilliant.
No, oh, wonderful. I look forward to reading that one. She, I think, comes from Appalachia. And so that is her community that she's writing from. So that sounds wonderful. That's great. Thank you. What are you working on next? Do you know?
I do know, but I don't know if I'm allowed to. I'm going to say,
and then I can
dibs it, because one of my terrors while I'm writing a story is always, what if someone else writes it first? So I am writing about the 6-week period in which Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, and kind of the pressure cooker environment in which she and Byron and Shelley, Polidori, who wrote the first sort of vampire fiction, were kind of enclosed in the year without summer, where a volcano had erupted. So it's tipping it down with rain, and they're all holed up in Geneva, and they have to write a ghost story. And yeah, just a little bit in a strange way, the question of what would it be like for that woman that sort of inspired Prize Women, like what would it be like to be in that situation where you have to have this enormous family? What would it be like to be in a situation where you're sort of enclosed in a claustrophobic environment with these men who are convinced that they're the cleverest people in the room, and yet you have this writing inheritance to live up to, where your mother was Mary Wollstonecraft and everyone expects you to produce something that's like a work of genius. And yet, you know, morning after morning, she was asked what she'd written, and she said, I haven't started yet. I can't think of a story. Ironically, the idea came for me after I'd spent sort of, you know, well, the 2 years since I wrote Prize Women, in which it's been kind of going through the publication and editorial process, thinking I can't think of a story. So there's something kind of auto-fictional, meta-fictional about the process of then writing about a writer who can't think of what to write.
Right, although it's also a little bit meta that she was under the pressure to create something, and you're saying, gee, I hope somebody else doesn't write it first.
Yes. I mean, if they do, I'm gonna write that into the story.
The other story that reminds me of is Chopin writing his, I think he wrote, what did he write when he was on a vacation in the rain with who was his lover? George Sand, right? Was that his lover? I'm going to look this up and take it out if I'm wrong.
But, I'm going to look it up and write it if you're right.
You may have that. That is yours.
Thank you.
We have just a few minutes left. So I always ask for advice for writers, and you're welcome to ignore my actual specific question and go in whatever direction you want for advice for writers. But I was thinking about how hard it must have been for you to write this book based on something rather outrageous, like the fact that he did this. Was that hard? Did that add to the difficulty of writing the book, that it was kind of a preposterous initial gambit that he put out there, or is that not really a question that addresses you, or that I should address to you?
No, I think there was the added challenge of with something that felt so outrageous and like such a big story, how I then wrote that on such a small, or what feels like a small scale of domestic life, because it is, you know, it's a little bit like when I go to my therapist and I say I've had a really bad week because I couldn't fit in the shopping and the cooking and the cleaning. And it's not about those things at all. It's the wider landscape of everything else that's going on. And so it was a little bit kind of, it was difficult to try and get the scale of the story set against the day-to-day existence of these women, and to how to incorporate that sense of peril and desperation that they must have felt, balanced against the drudgery of day-to-day existence. I don't know really where I go with advice from that for other writers, but I suppose it's the shaping that you do with every scene, where you're trying to add in a sense of what is what is at stake for the character at the end of this scene, even if they are only, you know, I think it was Kurt Vonnegut who said every character must want something, even if it's only a glass of water, which was kind of a helpful thing to bear in mind, that idea of what the character needs in every scene. And I suppose is another layer of why the relationship between Lily and May felt so crucial, because that added the sort of the wider context. Yeah, and so that kind of shaping of the scenes, I suppose, is what is maybe the writing advice. And the idea of trying to bring to your writing, you know, I talked a little bit before about the kind of the universal issues that all of us feel, you know. Historical fiction can feel very outdated, I think, if we're just looking at grand events, because they can feel really remote. That's not to say that it's bad writing. Shakespeare managed very well on it. But the idea of kind of these grand circumstances still need to be brought down to a level where we relate to the emotions that drive the characters scene by scene. And I suppose that's the thing that I tried to concentrate on.
That's wonderful. I like both of those pieces of advice, but the last thing you said really just... I like that a lot. I'm going to look at that later.
Thank you.
That's great. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Prize Women, published by HarperCollins and written by my guest today, Caroline Lee. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's really been, such a pleasure. You've been brilliant and so kind.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Caroline Lee, whose latest novel is Prize Women, published by Harper Perennial. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Caroline Lee. It's something that she has given to her students before. Go somewhere you wouldn't normally go and write about it. She says, don't get arrested, or if you do, don't blame her. She's had students go into cemeteries. She's had them go into other residence halls or dorms where they don't live and speak to students they wouldn't normally speak to. She says something about putting yourself in a different space, or hopefully a slightly uncomfortable position, forces something often very brilliant into your writing. So, good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. Write the Book ends in just a few weeks, but I'm still reading all of my email. I'd love your feedback about the show, and I'd love to hear your experience of being a listener. Let me know if you have upcoming events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it where you get your podcasts and tell your friends about it. The podcast will continue to exist at writethebook.podbean.com, at least for the foreseeable future. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well, and have a great week.